The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The fact that activists have just, they're leaving, right, and people are self-censoring. I mean, these are two really obvious consequences of what has happened. And this has happened for people who maybe never even participated in the protest. They're watching what they say. They're not the ones who are going to be technically targeted, if you think about what the national security laws is. They shouldn't be the ones who are targeted, but they are so worried about what this could mean for them that they are choosing to act differently.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 10th, 2021. Yes, we've had an insurrection in the United States. Yes, we've had an insurrection in Washington. But on the other side of the world, in Hong Kong, they are trying protesters under the city's new Beijing-imposed national security law. We thought it was a good time for an update on what's going on in Hong Kong and in its relationship with China. So we are joined in the virtual jungle studio by Sophia Yan from Beijing. Sophia is, of course, Lawfare's pianist, but in her day job, she's the Beijing correspondent for The Telegraph from London. We are also joined by Alvin Chung, joining us from Canada. Alvin Chung is a postdoctoral fellow at McGill University and a non-resident affiliate scholar of NYU's US-Asia Law Institute. We talked about how the national security law is being applied in Hong Kong, about whether the protests are likely to reignite as the coronavirus epidemic fades, and we talked about what activists are doing now that they don't know what Beijing will tolerate anymore. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 10th, an update from Hong Kong. Sophia, get us started. Bring us up to date on where things stand now in the relationship between Hong Kong and the Beijing government.
So it's been about 2 years now since Hong Kong, since this proposal in Hong Kong for this extradition bill was made and the first protests began. Since that time, we've had obviously the national security law come into place, and some arrests have been made under this law of journalists, of lawyers, of business people. And some of these cases are beginning to go to trial. The first one is in progress now. We don't have a lot of details about it, but there is some reporting saying that this trial will not be conducted with a jury. There are a lot of reasons why people are worried about what this means for freedoms in Hong Kong. And of course, not having a jury for a trial, that's just yet another one of these examples for why people are so scared.
And what's the volume of people who were facing trial for protests or for violations of the national security law?
There have been hundreds and hundreds arrested over the protests. And the system has been starting to process them through all of this. So some of the activists that are really well known, like Joshua Wong, they're facing charges for things like illegal assembly, organizing these protests and things like that. And they're moving, I suppose, as quickly as possible. I mean, there's so many of these people that are getting processed through the system. Of course, that takes some time. And there's a lot of discussion over what this will mean for the future. I mean, some of these people, for instance, have already been put in jail for other charges and then are charged again while they're in detention. Josh Wong is an example of that. He just keeps, the charges keep on rolling in for him. A lot of activists have chosen to leave, actually. We've seen a wave seeking asylum in countries in Europe and the UK. They're just trying to find another place to go. And one really interesting facet of what's happened in the last couple of months is that we've seen this protest movement offshore to move to other countries because it's become so difficult and dangerous for people to be organizing and to be talking about any of these issues on platforms in Hong Kong.
So, Alvin, this is what you've been warning about for a very long time. How should we understand this? Is this just the mask is off and being in Hong Kong is now only sort of optically different from being in anywhere else in China, at least in terms of your ability to voice political dissent?
I think on the whole, that assessment is correct. The Beijing and Hong Kong governments seem to have concluded, not without reason, that the international costs of engaging in overt repression are, if not minimal, then at least tolerable. And in some ways, I would suggest that being in Hong Kong now is more dangerous than being in certain parts of the mainland. And part of that is the rate at which new repressive measures are being introduced. And part of that is the zeal with which civil servants, particularly those in the uniformed services, will be performing their new duties in order to profess loyalty. Just to pick up on something Sophia alluded to, as of the 2nd of February, the police announced that they'd arrested 97 people under the NSL. Now, that, as Sophia says, does not include arrests made under any number of other offences. And on the 7th, a radio host was arrested under a colonial-era charge of seditious intent. So what we are seeing here is very much a case of very rapid recolonization, some of it using the NSL, but a lot of it using colonial-era apparatus that was just sitting there waiting to be used.
And the colonial-era apparatus, describe that as a legal matter. What does it entitle the government to do that's different from the national security law?
In terms of what substantively you can do under the old offenses, it is not altogether clear, partly because these offenses have not been used all that much, but partly because, at least since the 1990s, even the colonial era emergency legislation and national, quote unquote, national security offenses were supposedly subject to fundamental rights protections under the Bill of Rights Ordinance and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Now, of course, it is technically true that the NSL purports to respect the ICCPR, but I think it is clear now from the actions of both the Hong Kong and the mainland authorities operating in the territory that that is plainly not something that we should expect.
So, you know, I was talking the other day to Alina Polyakova about the crackdown on protests in Russia. And, you know, she was saying that basically the current rules allow arrest of anybody for just about anything. Is there a safe harbor in Hong Kong of any kind at this point? Or basically, are you subject to it? Like, if you're not protesting and you're not writing things or saying things that offend the CCP, are you at any particular risk as a result of the zeal that you describe? Or is it more this is a bullying effort to prevent the protests?
It's difficult to say whether there is any safe harbor. I would suggest that that uncertainty is by design. we've certainly seen instances where people were arrested simply for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, wearing the wrong sort of attire. From the authorities' perspective, it would be valuable to not establish any clear safe harbors. This is something that the author Perry Link referred to as the anaconda in the chandelier. You know, the idea that you never quite know when the state will come and get you, but you know that they're always there.
Yeah, I think the issue with the national security law is that because it's unclear how it will be used and applied and in what contexts, a lot of people are choosing to take the safer route, which is to lay low, keep their head down, and often self-censor. I mean, I know lots of people in Hong Kong, and I've talked to them for many years. Some of them have been very outspoken in the past. Some of them are sort of less so, but all of them are afraid of what they're saying, even what they're texting, what they're putting on certain platforms, even if it's just really private conversations. People are worried about what they're saying because they don't know what can be tracked and what can be found and in what way it could be used against them now or later in the future. And it's that fear of what could come that has had a very, very chilling effect.
You know, you say we don't know how the national security law is going to be used, but, you know, Alvin says there are 97 cases in which it already has been used. What do we know about the activity that it has so far been used to encompass?
That's a good question. I'm trying to pull up the press release in question, which frankly says nothing other than that national security related offenses are very serious. And it's been difficult for me at least to get detailed information on the specifics of the alleged offenses committed. But at this point, we have to take the NSL at face value, and what it purports to say is that it is extremely broad in its remit.
Sophia, do you have any sense of what these 97 cases are?
I just want to go back and clarify what I meant by, you know, it is the fact that this law could be so broadly defined. And that's why people are worried. I mean, it's you know, they do state very clearly crimes linked to terrorism, foreign collusion, secession, subversion. I mean, it is listed. But the problem is that the authority that's defining what, quote unquote, crimes fall under those buckets is an authority that could be quite biased against a certain kind of person.
The term subversion itself is hopelessly broad.
Yeah, exactly. It's this fear. In that sense, it's the fear of the unknown. It's like people don't know what actions and what their speech, like in what way that could be construed as to fall under one of those buckets. And that itself, I think, has been probably the most lasting impact of the national security law. Of course, people are getting arrested, but the wider sweeping way this has impacted the public and how they've changed their behaviors, I think that is actually in so many ways something that's often overlooked and very important in terms of what this law has meant. I mean, the fact that activists have just, they're leaving, right? And people are self-censoring. I mean, these are two really obvious consequences of what has happened. And this has happened for people who maybe never even participated in the protest. They're watching what they say. They're not the ones who are going to be technically targeted, if you think about what the national security law says. They shouldn't be the ones who are targeted, but they are so worried about what this could mean for them that they are choosing to act differently.
And what do we know about the number of people who have left? It has long been hypothesized that this was, you know, going to be the greatest thing that ever happened to Vancouver. And we've certainly seen a lot of reports of activists leaving. But do we have any sense of the numbers?
You know, I don't think I've seen any sort of big ballpark estimate just yet. The countries that have accepted people coming from Hong Kong generally haven't been very, very vocal about it. And same for the other way. I mean, these people, if they're trying to leave, need to keep their plans under wraps somewhat until they can get out. Otherwise, they could be prevented from leaving. I suppose from a foreign government perspective, they're concerned about saying too much and inviting the wrath of Beijing if they've taken in Hong Kong asylum seekers.
Right. Alvin, do you have a sense of the numbers?
I do not personally have a sense of the numbers. I've seen sort of anecdotally realtors are now increasingly advertising properties abroad, and you know, certain immigration consultants in Canada, where I'm currently based, appear to be doing a brisk business. But just to come back to give a bit of a counterpoint to what Sophia said about the ambit of the NSL, we know from the mainland's own domestic national security law and from the new quote-unquote national security teaching materials that the Hong Kong Education Bureau has released, that national security, at least as Beijing conceives of it, is incredibly broad. I have here in front of me something from the Education Bureau's materials, and they discuss, just reading verbatim, technological security, ecological security, cultural security, whatever that is, territorial security, social security, cyber security, and economic security. Now, that's a lot of things. That encompasses anything from importing cartoons and manga the authorities don't like to, for instance, short-selling certain stocks that happen to be stocks of, for instance, state champion corporations. So it's all very well for people like the Secretary for Justice, Theresa Cheng, to say, well, you know, you can go about your everyday lives. The NSL only implicates things that affect national security. But what remains unsaid is, well, actually, national security encompasses pretty much anything we can think of. And as Sophia says, it can be unilaterally redefined by the National People's Congress Standing Committee at any time.
All right, so you wrote, Alvin, an article in a journal I had not previously heard of called Critical Asian Studies, which takes to task in very sharp terms American China experts and left commentators on China for their sort of continued excuses for the Chinese Communist Party and its crackdown in Hong Kong, as well as their refusal to, you know, look in the face what's happening in Xinjiang. You seem to have a sort of particular anger with the left about this. So walk us through the argument of the piece a little bit. Who are you pissed off at here?
I think it would be quicker for me to list who I am not pissed off at. The genesis of the piece is that one of the editors at Critical Asian Studies approached me to write about the recent wave of arrests. I think it was 53 and counting. And given the particular focus of the journal, I thought it would be a good opportunity to take on not only mainstream, quote-unquote, China watching, but also the typical leftist critique of what is perceived as the dominant narrative. So on the one hand, mainstream China policy opinion, at least as I have encountered it since the middle of 2013, is essentially encapsulated in the phrase, well, I see no problem in Hong Kong, which is, in fact, something somebody said to me in as many words in the summer of 2013, when it became clear that a massive pro-democracy civil disobedience campaign was going to happen. And it's this sort of willful ignorance that I've seen time and again from the same few figures who are making the same pronouncements on China policy and have been for the past 7.5 years. That has been, A, absolutely infuriating on a personal level, but B, more significantly, has materially contributed, in my view, to the impression on the part of the Beijing and the Hong Kong governments that there is very little international cost to taking the mask off and engaging in overt repression. So that's the first target. The second target, the self-identified left, are essentially people who, in the name of opposing Western white colonialism, seem perfectly happy for Han Chinese to engage in exactly the same behavior. And it is deeply hypocritical, it's cynical in the extreme, and it denies moral agency both to the people of Hong Kong and the Uyghurs of Xinjiang, who the left do not seem to view as human beings. And at the same time, it denies that anybody in the Chinese Communist Party has any moral agency, which is dehumanizing in a different way. So I've chosen to take on two sacred cows in the course of a single fiery op-ed, but I have to say this one has been in some ways many years in the making.
So Sophia, what is the reciprocal discussion in China like right now? Is the relative quietness of the US on this being noted? And to what extent are these trials in Hong Kong getting discussed in the mainland?
So the ballpark numbers are sometimes reported, this 97 arrested under the national security law. Chinese state media, for instance, will have that. But again, it's really broad in terms of how they couch it. There are no details from the Hong Kong government or from the Chinese side when they talk about it through state media or from higher levels in government about who's been targeted and under for what reason. It's meant to give this sense of like power that China's taking control and that everything is going to be fine. And it's just part of this narrative that China wants to push, that Hong Kong is under, you know, that they've been able to bring Hong Kong to heel. And that kind of line has always been there in terms of what people know that's sort of dependent on whether or not you've got a VPN, really. The one bit that has begun to change is actually with the UK. The UK has offered a path to citizenship for some people in Hong Kong, people who have this British national overseas passport, and it would give them a visa and the right to live and work in the UK for a few years before applying for citizenship. And this has actually drawn a lot of attention from the Chinese side. They're very upset about this in particular. They see it as a meddling of internal Chinese affairs, and they've directed a lot of that anger toward the UK. It's been interesting, actually, the last few months, you haven't really seen that kind of anger directed so much to the US over the Hong Kong issue as you have seen with the UK. It has really increased in the last few weeks because that passport citizenship option just became valid very recently. And so you've seen this uptick in terms of how China wants to couch it and in how it wants to target the UK over doing this.
And is your sense that the UK, I mean, this is a very big issue for China and a middling small issue for the UK. Is your sense that China just means to stare the UK down on it, or that there's going to be a sort of agree to disagree about it? And if some people in Hong Kong move to the UK, that's not the biggest problem in the world from China's point of view.
For China, it's an embarrassment, really, that so many people want to leave. And being aided by a foreign government to leave, this, from Beijing's perspective, doesn't look great. It's an issue of face in a lot of ways, an issue of sovereignty because they think of Hong Kong as theirs. And most of all, it's destabilizing in the sense that they spend all this time saying that the Communist Party is the best thing on the planet and provides for the people. So if that were the case, and if it were really true, why would even one person want to leave? So it's, on a PR front, not good for China, but also for the China-UK relationship. From the UK side, this is part of a much wider range of China-related issues that have now been put on the table. The UK has become more vocal about human rights abuses in Xinjiang, for instance. They were talking about the Huawei situation already, espionage and intelligence security risks around that. Obviously, there's the Hong Kong issue now. And more recently, just last week, the British broadcast regulator Ofcom ruled to ban Chinese state broadcaster CGTN, that's their English language channel, from broadcasting in the UK because it breaks all these rules that they have in the UK about who can broadcast. You're meant to have control over your editorial content, and that organization that's broadcasting cannot be controlled by a political body. And so the investigation that this regulator did find that the Communist Party does oversee Chinese state media, and as such, this particular broadcaster can no longer air programs in the UK. And so this is a very wide picture of what's happening now between UK-China relations. And as a whole, it's going to be pretty rocky times that we're in for.
So you are a American reporter of Chinese ethnicity working for a British paper in China.
With Taiwanese immigrant parents. I check all the boxes.
So where does that leave you in terms of, I mean, you know, the British government is regulating Chinese broadcasters and kicking them off networks, and you're sitting there, you know, working for a British newspaper in China. Does that have any blowback for you?
That's the big question now. You know, China wants to always move and take what they consider to be reciprocal measures. And in this case, the last few weeks, they've made a big push to target the BBC. From China's perspective, the BBC is equivalent to their CGTN, their state broadcaster, the Chinese state broadcaster. Obviously, it's not equivalent, right? They're not exactly apples. It's not really apples to apples comparison here, CGTN and BBC. But as they've geared up to do this, especially with this particular decision in the UK that had been looming over CGTN, I mean, sort of all signs point to the fact that the fallout might impact an organization like the BBC. That doesn't preclude other British media outlets. And China, in its retaliation in the past, as we saw last year, especially as things ramped up between the US and China, they really target organizations via the national origin of the outlet. Less so, that seems to take more priority than the nationality of the journalist. So if something were to occur, for instance, against any British media outlet, it wouldn't really matter if you were American or Australian or Italian or whatnot. From the Chinese side, they would be seeing that as a move against the Brits, even though obviously the press is not linked to the government. So, you know, there's a chance, and I guess we'll see. But hey, you know, live to see another day.
So, Alvin, what about Canadian Chinese relations? I mean, the brisk business you describe in the Canadian real estate market surely has been noticed by the Chinese.
Well, it came to light in, I think, the Globe and Mail, which is one of the papers of record, that apparently the agency that processes applications for visas to Canada in Beijing is actually run by the Ministry of State Security. Just to give you an idea of how flat-footed Ottawa has been and how much the party is eating our collective lunch, the other scandal that happened relatively recently is that that Global Affairs Canada, so our counterpart to the State Department, agreed to buy, I think it was either metal detectors or X-ray machines for all of its foreign missions from a firm with ties to the People's Liberation Army. So yes, there is an effort in Parliament through the Special Committee on Canada-China Relations to bring questions like Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and broader questions of Sino-Canadian relations into the spotlight. But at least as far as the executive is concerned, there seems to have been absolutely nothing, and certainly nothing like what we're seeing now in the UK and in the US under the new Secretary of State.
So talk to us about that. You know, the Trumpist flank of American politics believes that Joe Biden is in the pocket of the Chinese Communist Party and believes that, you know, the Democrats will be very weak on China, whatever that means. How do you understand what changes we should expect, if any, in policy toward things like Hong Kong from the new administration?
Well, if reports about Secretary of State Blinken's first phone conversation with his PRC counterpart are to be believed, this new administration will, in fact, be vocal on issues like Xinjiang and Hong Kong. I think the tone of the conversation has, as far as US-China policy is concerned, has now, I would say, incredibly belatedly started to shift. And so there is, I suspect, no turning back the clock on the some degree of hardening of rhetoric and some reevaluation of past premises. Although I will say I am much more confident that this administration will be more consistent and less erratic in applying whatever China policy it eventually does pursue.
Sophia, how is it playing in China? Has there been talk of any consequence of what the new administration means for China on issues of human rights or other matters?
Beijing seems to be treading water for now. They've made some comments about this. They said they're happy to work with the U.S. and other nations on pandemic cooperation, on issues of climate change, but there are red lines, and those red lines continue to increase. And those red lines are Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, these human rights issues. I mean, they've made it clear, China, that they will not engage unless the other side, the U.S. in this case, drops its issues with those topics, with human rights abuses, for instance, in Xinjiang and the Hong Kong issue. And so really it's a non-starter already. China's already saying, we don't want to engage unless you will ignore these topics. They have to say that, China, and there's no reason to doubt that they mean it. The point of doing this now at the start of the Biden administration is to make very clear where they see that starting line. Of course, the Biden administration sees it very differently, and so then the question is, how will the U.S. and China come to sit at the same table? And we have yet to see how that's going to happen. I imagine the Biden administration's hashing out what they're going to do, how to do it, and they could be quite effective, but still do it in a way that doesn't invite very strong public backlash from the Chinese that can have really wide fallout, as we saw last year, fallout that included journalists, for instance.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's another big factor here, which is what happens in Hong Kong itself. It's much easier to let something like this simmer down to a low boil where the Chinese say it's non-negotiable and the U.S. makes some impressive sounding but ultimately pro forma statement on occasion, if there's actually not that much happening in Hong Kong in the way of protests that are being repressed. It's much harder if you have situations like you have had at different times over the last year or so, where there's hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. And so I guess I'm curious for both of your sense of what the street in Hong Kong is likely to be like over the next few weeks. Has the crackdown been successful enough to remove this functionally from the day-to-day conversation?
So I would say that the coronavirus pandemic came, you know, in terms of how the Chinese government would look at it, it came at a very convenient time because that was a very physical reason why protests had to end. I mean, there were social distancing laws and measures in place that helped in terms of keeping some sort of lid on the protests. But what the Chinese can't control quite as much is the fact that this movement has moved offshore. We still have to see, you know, it remains to be seen how successful the movement will be offshore, how the activists are able to organize. You know, it risks becoming something, in a sense, like Tibet. There are a lot of activists around the world, but we have so little information about what's actually happening within Tibet. With Hong Kong, there, by comparison, will hopefully continue to be much more insight into what's going on there. But because the people there are so afraid to speak and to be connected to people overseas, we may have some sort of info gap as to what's going on really on the ground. Of course, this is made more complicated because it's harder to travel with the pandemic. So going forward, I think one of the big concerns is how all these offshore centers further the movement and in what way China chooses to act against them, if they do at all. I mean, this could become yet another source of contention between countries. You know, it could be another reason why diplomatic relations sour.
Alvin, what do you think? Is the relative quiet on the streets of Hong Kong a function principally of the repression, principally of coronavirus, or a combination of the two? And will it lift, you know, when the coronavirus vaccination happens in a big way and life returns to normal? Are the protests coming back, or have they successfully put a cap on this?
As for the causes of the current quiet on the streets, I think it is a combination of the two factors. Just to sort of date myself, I was in high school when SARS 1.0 happened. In fact, I lived down the road from the Prince of Wales Hospital, which became one of the epicenters of the outbreak. So my sense, at least of, you know, based on what people remember of that outbreak, is that they do take public health advisories extremely seriously. On the other hand, it is also painfully obvious that quote-unquote public health measures are now being weaponized. We're seeing these ambush-style lockdowns that do very little except aggravate the populace and target districts that are mainly inhabited by the socially disadvantaged. And, you know, there are reports that Beijing loyalists will be first in line to get vaccines. So, you know, even if Hong Kong does get an effective vaccine, and that remains up in the air, I don't think it will be the end of the matter.
The other issue with all these Hong Kongers leaving is that over time, people who have the means and want to leave will not be in the city anymore. That could mean then that the remaining population becomes much more malleable. And this goes into what many fear, that Hong Kong will become, quote unquote, just another Chinese city, that the people who would have arranged and organized protests, the people who would have spoken out, maybe they won't be there anymore because they're out of the city. And the ones who, the few that may still be in Hong Kong, of course, then are silenced by the national security law. And that is definitely a very much a long lasting impact that could very much change the fabric of Hong Kong as we know it.
We're going to leave it there. Sophia Yan, Alvin Chung, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Ian Enright, proprietor of Goat Rodeo. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, so tweet us, share us on Facebook, pin us on Pinterest, all the social media stuff. You should buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com. And of course, you should leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by, you guessed it, you're listening to her, our guest, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.